So today we are going to be completing our discussion of essay number 3 on freedom and responsibility. And Paul is going to return to the question that originally began this essay, which is food offered to idols. We're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 verses 23 through chapter 11 verse 1. This whole thing is on freedom and responsibility. The question that was in the letter that the Corinthian church sent to Paul asked, what about food offered to idols? And Paul's response initially was, Christians must surrender their personal rights for the sake of others. The Corinthian believers, at least some of them, were concerned about, what am I allowed to do? What are my rights? And Paul says that's the wrong question. The right question is, what can I do to serve others? And then Paul went on to describe his own life, how he applied the concept of balancing freedom and responsibility in his own life. Part of it has to do with the fact that some were questioning whether Paul was an apostle, really truly an apostle or not, because he had refused to accept support from them. And so Paul defends his authority, apostolic authority, and his rights. Says, I know I have a right to receive support from you, but I'm going to refuse support, so that the Corinthians would not have a claim on him, for one thing. They couldn't tell him what to do, because monetary support or any kind of support came with strings attached, and Paul didn't want to be tied to that.
And see, you can say that a lot easier than other ministers who receive a paycheck.
Paul wanted the only claim upon his life to be from Christ himself. And so, as a result, he refused all support for ministering to a congregation. However, he would accept support in order to minister to others. That was a different thing. So for travel expenses and things like that, to get to a new place, you would accept that support, because then he would be far away and it would be hard for the people supporting him to control him. And the other reason why he refused support was to illustrate the free nature of the gospel. And that whole idea that the gospel is free, that grace is free, that there are no strings attached. Part of the reason the gospel is offensive is that it is free. So you can't, there's nothing you can do in return.
Okay, so why is there tithe then?
Tithe, strictly speaking, is found in the Old Testament only.
Okay.
And so it was their whole civic and spiritual, everything in one bowl, the tithe.
And in the New Testament, both Paul as well as the other apostles that wrote, and Jesus himself does support the idea that ministers of the word, ministers of the gospel, should be supported by those that receive ministry.
In this section, Paul does talk about the ox has a right to eat for his labor. Right?
Right.
But in response to your question, Paul takes a different tactic than what we historically had thought he was. A different tactic than what I historically had thought Paul was driving at. So the question you just asked was asked by the people of Paul, what about support of the ministry?
And Paul's response is, minister, you should support them, but I personally am going to refuse that support because it comes with too many strings attached. Because I value my freedom more than support.
So, the answer to your question, what about the obligation of tithe? And Paul said, God's grace is free. If you don't pay tithe, that does not affect your free, your salvation or the free gift of God.
Well, they may have wanted to put some strings on him. And so they were actually trying to pressure him into taking the money. And he's like, I'm not going to take it. Because once, in as worldly people know, once there's money, there's also expectations. And, or demands, could be. And he wasn't going to go there. But, you know, there's a lot of reasons to give tithe and more as you feel, you know, is right.
And Paul certainly wasn't against giving. In fact, you know, he kind of, as he was in his missionary journeys, would pit one church against another in competition to see how much they could give to give in order to support other churches.
Right. So basically, like, his point is that with your understanding of being a Christian, tithe is kind of a given, and you're going to do it because you're just walking that way and it'll be done. But it's not a form of payment, in other words,
right,
to receive your wishes. It is, right, it is nothing more than just the service of man, like you should be doing. So, it's not an obligation, but it is a will that you'll probably do.
Yeah, so next, Paul, in this essay, wrote about how he himself entered into the lives, into the communities of the places where he ministered. He didn't go there to serve, but rather to become a part of their community. There's a difference. He talked about the difference. Now, when you go to serve, you are always in a position of strength. Where when you go, so he became weak in order to serve the weak, in order to minister. He became weak to be a part of the people there. And there was the verse or the passage towards the end of this chapter 9 in 1 Corinthians where Paul talks about discipline, of disciplining yourselves. And I think frequently it's been interpreted to mean that you need to be diligent to discipline yourselves to maintain your salvation, because otherwise you might fall away. And in the context of what Paul is writing here, it's all about mission, saying that in order for a person to identify fully, to enter fully into the lives, to live as that the people that you're with, requires great discipline, because it may go against the things that you have been taught. It may go against your preferences of food and drink.
No, no, that's
it's
not
kind of, yeah.
The whole section, when read from the viewpoint of mission,
that's about how far he's saying.
Yeah.
You study, you become it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, you really have to immerse yourself in this culture to try to get their mindset so that you know what they are thinking.
So in Paul's own example, when he was among Jews, he kept all of the Jewish traditions. He sacrificed at the temple.
A lot of them.
He did what was expected of a observant Jew, so as not to offend the Jews. When he went to the Gentiles, he could not become a Gentile because he's a Jew. But he would, in all ways possible, in all ways that were, that did not violate, all ways that did not violate his spiritual allegiance to Christ, he would behave as a Gentile. The next section, Paul talked about a couple of the Jewish sacraments. He talked about the Exodus story, passage through the Red Sea, as a metaphor for Christian baptism, and he wrote about the miraculous provision of the manna as a metaphor for the communion service, as well as the miraculous provision of water. The water and the manna as part of the communion or Eucharist. And part of it was that there may have been in the Corinthian church a magical view of these sacraments of baptism and communion, that if you participated in these things, you were somehow immune to pagan influences, so that a person could in fact go worship at a pagan temple and be immune from that. And Paul is saying, no, the sacraments aren't magic. These sacraments are valuable in that they remind those who partake of it of who they are, of who Christ is. And then in the preceding section that we covered last week, Paul discussed the idea of, so can a Christian participate in pagan worship services? And Paul's response to that was, no. Idols aren't real. However, the spiritual forces behind what they represent are real. He called them demons. Christians can't belong to both kingdoms. You belong to either Christ's kingdom or to the kingdom opposed to it. And by participating in those activities that glorify those powers that are against Christ, you are placing yourself into that kingdom rather than Christ.
So that's a modern form of that would be the Masonic Temple. Because they offer all religions the chance to be part of their club. But in order to raise in the ranks, you have to admit to the power of the person that's asking you to at the time. So it's like, this is the one, like you have to admit power to the grand person before you and say that you relinquish your will to them, or, you know, your right to them. So you're basically having to dishonor your God at that time and prove a promise to a human individual and to a sanctity of a group. And so that'd be kind of a direct analogy to that, where, you know, you technically could not be a part of that club as a Christian because you're being asked to say that there's something more powerful in your life than God before God. You know, they're not letting you say, yeah, God's my goal, but you're my buddy. They're saying you have to admit to them first. And it's just kind of, I guess that'd be kind of the same thing.
Well, what is important to note is that throughout these sections, Paul is generally speaking primarily about the collective church. He's not speaking to individuals. So he's... So what he is saying is that, you know, as a church, cannot endorse certain activities. And this is where, in chapter 10, verse 13, there's that famous, well-known text, you know, flee from... No, that's verse 14. That's flee from idolatry. That's where... verse 13 is where the Paul writes, no temptation has overtaken you as to where you can't, you know...
Way of escape.
Right, where way of escape hasn't been provided. And frequently that text has been taken as a kind of a proof text that you will never face trials, never face any life trials that you can't handle. Where in this context here, it is speaking primarily about the temptation to idolatry. It's not about whether or not you will face other types of life trials, because people do face trials that, you know, that they can't really handle. So it's not a general promise. It's a specific promise in regards to, you know, this temptation to compromise. And
which throws just a huge monkey wrench in this idea that if you love God, you can handle it. It's like,
well, that God won't give you more than you can handle.
That's if God gave you anything. You spent a lot of time trying to differentiate the difference between a Christian sacrament and a idolatry practice.
For Jerry's benefit.
Mm-hmm. And this way of escape is not some magical, miraculous thing. It's to flee. So verse 14 was flee from idolatry. See, Christians should not even go to those places.
That's what I was saying about the Masonic lodges, is that you're being asked to basically form an idolatry relationship with your group. And the only way you can abstain from that is to not at all be part of it.
If you realize at some point that it's idolatrous, you should get out of there.
Well, it very much is. If you're being asked, if you're being asked to regard somebody or something as your one provider of information before God, then that's idolatry, and you're being asked to relinquish your grace of God before the information that you get. You know, this is before God, so that, yeah, it's very much that.
What constitutes idolatry?
So what is idolatry?
I have to say, it's just like what Paul went through when he didn't eat the food from Baal and then had to explain it. He was giving his faith to that God to save him or to give him his life purpose or information, or, you know, just that's idolatry, is you're giving that to something that is considered terrestrial or handleable. You can control by offering or changing or doing something physically, I guess.
You used the word control. And I think what Mark's trying to explain, but I'm having a hard time to get up, is in a Christian world, Christ gave a free gift. And we can provide free responses. But in an idolatry, you try to control your God by your gifts. And so the idolatry is a mind where you are controlling the idol, your gods.
Yeah, idolatry has to do with what I've called kind of this magical thinking, where you can do something in order to appease a power stronger than you, or to bribe a power stronger than you in order to get what you want. See, when Jesus Christ, he gave up his rights and his freedoms. And Christians are supposed to follow that example in order to be of benefit to others. Idolatry is the opposite of that. It's the acquisition of rights and freedoms for your benefit.
It's my right.
And by bringing up the Masonic temple, from the little I understand of it, isn't the Masonic temple built upon different levels of accomplishment where you have more and more?
Absolutely. You're trading your condition for knowledge. So if you've obtained this much time, this much seniority, and gone through these so said trials, then you're able to gain another level of the temple.
Christ gave us life free with no strings.
As well as Scientology is, and other religions, similar religions, it's a modern form of the old Greek mystery religions, which became Gnosticism. Basically, you acquire certain knowledge, and you can advance.
But idolatry is right in this church. When I give an offering, or if I do something in my mind in order to influence or to solve my conscience that now I have the right for something. God has an obligation now to keep me well because I have done this and this and this.
Yeah. That's magical thinking. That is idolatry.
So it's the mind that's the idolatry. It's what you place on your actions.
And so this, with all that now, Paul is going to wrap everything up here. One thing in kind of the background of all this is that when meat was offered to idols, there were different ways that it happened. It could be a private sacrifice in which a family might go to the temple, to the pagan temple, to offer a sacrifice. And some of that sacrifice would be consumed by the family at the temple. Other times, it would be a public festival in which large amounts of sacrifices were offered. And some of it would be consumed by the priests there. Some of it might be offered kind of like in a restaurant fashion at the temple for people to come and eat. And any excess meat would then be sold in the local marketplace.
Would that money attribute toward the church or toward the
probably, so at least some of it.
Or something like that.
And so
probably the cheapest meat of the year.
Right, and it would be the only meat that the poor would be able to afford. So this question that the Corinthian church posed to Paul involves kind of all of that. And what Paul had clearly stated now is that a person could not go to a pagan temple to participate and eat there. But what about what was available in the marketplace? Because some of it would have been offered to idols, some of it wouldn't have been, and it wasn't always identified which was which.
Right. So if you bought the ground beef, you wouldn't know.
Right. Or what if you go to a private home of a pagan friend and you were offered meat? How do you know?
Right.
Or does it matter? And that's what we're going to get into.
We're going to get into?
Yes.
Well, you addressed a little bit of that.
Yeah, Paul has been addressing a little of that throughout, but he's going to bring it all together here. So this chapter 10, verses 23 through the first verse of chapter 11, unfortunate chapter division, is a seven-part ring composition plus a final note. Basically, what Paul is going to say is, in private homes, whether it's in yours or others, don't worry about food rules. Doesn't matter where the meat comes from.
It's like pagan food rules anyway. It's like that.
No, if you buy from the marketplace, don't ask. No, it doesn't matter. But what he's going to say right in the center is, but be considerate of an unbeliever whose scruples might be offended if he points out to you that this meat was offered to idols.
I can just visualize, oh, look at this good, is that not, oh. You just keep going.
The main point is, throughout this entire essay, is don't let your actions hinder mission.
Yeah, because offending somebody at the core of our way of relating with each other, which is food offered to each other, mm-hmm. it's the kind of a very deep offense for somebody to be offered to somebody's home, to be asked to eat with them, mm-hmm. and then the person saying, oh, I can't eat that. You know, I'm sorry you cooked this great dinner, but let's have some wine instead. And that's a big offense to people. Or it's also making people have to change to serve you rather than you serve them.
Yeah.
Because if you're coming into their home and they're like, oh, well, you don't eat that. Ah, let me change my whole deal to serve you instead of you coming into their home to minister and to serve them and to be with them in Christ. You're not doing that by making them make you a special dinner.
Yeah.
Well, what happens is the person, the missionary that's coming, may be of an economic status that he can get food and meat that is pure, but when he visits this person who doesn't have an economic ability to buy anything other than what's sold on the common market, that meat is subject to question. And so it's an economic abuse.
That's a good point, too.
Can you imagine some wealthy minister being invited to a poor person's house and they're saying, they might apologize, I'm sorry, this is really food from the temple. And
it's only for the market, you don't
and
know.
And he's like, I mean, the gracious thing to do is, it's okay, it's fine.
Well, we'll get to what exactly Paul's point is here as we go through. So, all things are lawful. That's probably in the letter that the Corinthians sent to Paul. It was repeated in chapter 6.
Good question, yeah.
All things are lawful. Now, that's their assertion. But Paul says, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful. And Paul replies, but not all things build up. And then he goes on, let no one seek his own good or advantage, but the good or the advantage of his neighbor. And this can be translated, the other. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Or for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. If one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you are disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice. And this word offered in, this has been offered in sacrifice, it uses the term which means sacrificial meat instead of idol meat. Which we'll get into, but there's a significance there. This has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat it for the sake of the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I did not mean your conscience, but his. For why should my liberty be determined by someone else's conscience or scruples? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of that for which I give thanks? So whatever you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense to the Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. Just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, as I am of Christ. So, what does this passage seem to be saying to you? Before we go into detail. Any thoughts? How does it fit into the rest of this essay that we've looked at?
So whatever you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God.
And God
in context.
God seeks not to offend. And that's what he was saying about when you go, if you choose to be a missionary, all aren't cut out for that work. But if you are, it's kind of over the top of your comfort zone a lot of times. Mm-hmm. But study so you can not delete your influence over people.
Paul grew up and was trained as a Pharisee.
He was it. He knew everything.
Prior to his
conversion
and ministry to the Gentiles, he would not have even considered touching or even being with Gentiles. And now he's saying, I eat whatever is given to me.
Where's the verse?
So
know you not that your temple is the body of God?
It's in a couple different places.
That, in conjunction with this one, so whatever you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do all the glory of God. When you put this one in context, this is interesting.
So when you're offered that food that you're not supposed to partake of, but are supposed to, in the name of God, are you to... See that, where it stalls out for me is okay, so you're in this position, you're offered something, everything is okay, but not this one thing. But if you do it with the glory of God, then it should be okay to do it. Are you exalting that to the for the people? Because you're for the people's sake. How are you taking that? How are you doing it so that it's for their sake, not yours? And you're eating the sacrificed meat because it's for their sake, not yours. How are you doing that for the glory of God? How do you know you're doing that for that reason in that particular time?
Well, part of it is, for Paul, the place matters. It's the what isn't nearly as important as where.
So if you're in a temple, you definitely aren't going to do it.
But you shouldn't be in the temple at all.
Right. Okay.
You're supposed to be fleeing.
So if you're in a home and somebody says, this is meat that's sacrificed for so-and-so, let us eat, and you're supposed to not do that unless you do it for the glory of God. So are you just there and you're going to partake in it so that you can still bridge this gap with these people, or...
Oh, I think the reason they would tell you is because they think you have a conscience to not eat this. And they're probably, if they fix it, they know he has a conscience about that, they're probably going to say, this was, and
yeah,
this wasn't.
We're going to talk about the host versus guests.
Yeah, we forgot. There's a very key word. I do not mean your conscience, but his conscience.
So he's doing it to try to inform you, I would think. Because I'm in this shoes often nowadays, and they'll say, oh, this has meat and this has meat. They're doing it for my sake of telling me that something has been, quote, offered nothing, or, telling me for my sake. And I feel bad that I don't eat everything because I want to be that, but I haven't gone that far yet.
We'll talk about you just for a moment. He talks about the conscience. You can refuse to eat something because you have an allergy. You can refuse to eat something because you have an upset stomach, and so if you ate it, you would actually throw up. You can refuse to eat something, but if you're refusing for conscience sake, that's what he's talking about. It's a different. I mean, there's no reason for you to say, I have a religious principle, therefore I have to eat these spiders and then eat it and then throw up. That's not nice. The question isn't conscience there. That question there is your emotional stability, which is okay.
So, third question here is, how important is it that we see this passage that I just read in the context of the entirety of chapter 8 through the beginning of chapter 11?
Question again?
The question is it important, and in what way is it important that we see this passage in context of this entire essay number 3?
Because it absolves, or it puts together the freedoms and responsibilities of both it puts in context your freedom and your responsibility at the same time. Passage is stating in an overall what you're supposed to do and what you can do or whatever. Maybe.
It's trying to not let you botch up relationships. It's trying to build somebody up instead of rip them down.
Yeah.
And it can be done so unintentionally if you don't think.
Yeah, so without this passage, the rest of the essay you might say, well, I won't eat any forbidden any foods that are forbidden by my
Jewish
tradition or religion. Without the rest of this essay, you might read this and say, well, it doesn't matter what other people think. It doesn't matter what, I can do whatever I want.
I think when you understand what the glory of God is, it's not the glory of God for you, it's the glory of God for others. If you're always thinking it's about you, you're going to miss the point. So if you're...
I grew up, and I believe that most people would have been taught growing up. So, make sure that what you eat and what you drink is good stuff, and that it is going to glorify God. That is what we were led to believe, it says. Is make sure you're only eating good stuff for God's glory.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what it's saying.
In other words, it's about kind of your personal health or personal well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. What it's saying is, if you eat meat or don't eat meat, if you eat slop or you don't eat slop, whatever you do, make sure that your choice is based upon glorifying God in the other person's mind.
Okay. All right, so let's look at the outer envelope, numbers parts 1 and 7. The emphasis that's found in both sections is, don't seek your own advantage. Seek the good or the salvation of the other. That's the guiding principle. Or another way of saying it is, it's not about my rights, but what will build up the community? And let's look at the Good Samaritan story, as well as these couple passages in Leviticus chapter 19.
The Good Samaritan story.
Yeah, the Good Samaritan story is found in Luke chapter 10. In Luke chapter 10 here.
In the good old days in the Bible, they searched to and fro, which means they went to their scrolls, we go through our Bibles, and this guy goes
tap, tap, tap. Yeah.
Got to tap, tap.
So I'm going to read this whole thing, starting with verse 25 through and going through 37. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your might, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" He said, "The one who showed him mercy." And Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." We're going to jump to Leviticus chapter 19. Let's see. And what am I looking for here? Verses 17, 18, and 33, 34. Okay. So, 17 and 18. "You shall not hate your brother in your heart, but you shall reason frankly with your neighbor, lest you incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So in these two verses, your neighbor is your brother. Someone who is basically, you know, your family, your tribe, you know, someone who is ethnically related to you. Now we go to, what is it, 33 and 34, Leviticus 19, which reads, "When a stranger sojourns with you in your hand, in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." So in these two verses, kind of your neighbor becomes anyone who is in your land, including the stranger, someone who lives among you, who is not part of your family or your tribe ethnically, but happens to be among you. So the lawyer and the Good Samaritan woman that posed the question to Jesus, and when Jesus in response tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, this lawyer may have been asking, "So who is my neighbor? Is it my brother or the stranger among us?" Jesus offers a third option. He uses this word, "the other," meaning the other who is not among you. So it's neither your brother nor the stranger among you, but the other who is not among you. And Paul uses the same word that's found in the parable of the Good Samaritan in verse 24, in chapter 10, verse 24 of 1 Corinthians. "Let no one seek his own good, but the good of the other." Which has been translated neighbor frequently.
Now, we spent a lot of time on the weaker brother. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't offend the weaker brother. And I had thought, up till just this moment, of something in regards to this text that always made sense, but I think I got flipped on my head because you said this is all about mission. Okay, I'm going to go to a other's house, and I'm going to take with me a weaker brother. We sit down at the table, and out of respect for my host, he offers meat, and I'm going to accept the meat so as not to offend my host, but my weaker brother, who I brought, said, oh, that stuff may be offered to idols. Therefore, out of deference to my weaker brother, I will not eat that meat. That is the scenario that has been given to me for years. This is true. But that, and so in order not to offend all these weaker brothers in the church, we should not exercise our freedom to our host. But in the light that you've given this, the error was mine in that I should never have brought my weaker brother in a missionary position if he wasn't going to be able to honor the host. So the error is, in my thinking, was that we're supposed to defer to the weaker brother. The error is I shouldn't be bringing the weaker brother. I need to
He's not prepared for mission.
Probably.
He's not prepared to cast his self aside. So when you go visiting, you just go by yourself.
All through life, I have been taught, Skudenki, I have understood that we should abide by all these rules just so we don't offend all these weaker brothers that are hypothetically all out there. And that keeps us on the narrow and straight way.
No. If you really wanted to make sure you never offend anybody, you just bring your dog with you and scrape your plate over the side of the table.
So the whole point is this conscience, we're talking about the host and the missionary. There's no hypothetical third party in these things.
Perhaps. We'll continue here. Paul is best understood to be urging his readers to reach out to the one who is different. That's what he's doing here. So, a question that the readers of this may have had is, how precisely does Paul intend his readers to apply, not all things are helpful and not all things build up, and to seek the good of the other? First, don't offend anyone. But this doesn't mean don't critique.
I'm sorry, I don't have this. What are we reading?
We've been right here. Don't offend anyone. But this doesn't mean don't critique right here. That's what
he just said. Okay, but I was trying to see who wrote that. You wrote that question.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
The standard is, so give no offense to Jews, Greeks, or to the church. For Paul, there will be no public attacks on the faith of others.
That's exactly what I've always heard. We should not give offense to Jews, Greeks, or to the church.
So this is from a commentary. For Paul, there will be no public attacks on the faith of others. Critical analysis, yes. Attacks, no. So for example, we've already read in this essay, Paul did critique the idolatry in Corinth. But there is no attack on any of these idols, their sacred books, their temples, or their priests. When lecturing on Mars Hill, Paul found common ground between his message and respected Greek authors. In Paul's ministry, tolerance, open-mindedness, and respect flowed together with critical analysis and non-apologetic evangelism. Apologetic evangelism is basically
dogma.
Dogma, defending your faith and attacking the other as false.
I like that word. Non-apologetic evangelism. I like that.
So what Paul, I think, is saying here is critique the data. Don't attack people or their beliefs. This doesn't mean the receiving party of the critique will never be offended, but that's not your problem. Paul's words thus should be understood as strive to minimize causing offense. Because you can't control how... You can... Do your best to just critique the facts.
I lost.
There's history. You can state history without slamming them.
Your inset box, the first paragraph, the standard is given. I didn't see how you type that in.
The standard of behavior. you know, not all things are helpful, not all things build up, seek the good of the other.
No, but I'm saying the standard is give no offense to Jews, Greeks, or the
right.
church. But from what I think I'm hearing is Paul is saying, as a missionary, your objective is not to not offend Jews. Your objective is not to offend the church. Your objective is to reach, non-apologetically, to the outsider, the other.
Well, the give no offense is verse 32 here. Give no offense to Jews or the Greeks or the Church of God, just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, that but that of many, that they may be saved. In other words, for Paul, everyone is the mission field. The Jews, the Greeks, even the church.
Oh, okay. But he's not even talking about, by not giving offense to the Greeks, is he going to offend a Jew or a church? He's not even talking about that.
No.
Okay, I saw him.
And the second point here, when you don't offend, you have a better opportunity to gain a hearing of the gospel message. That's what Paul is trying to do. Again, from a commentary, Paul's point, of course, is related to behavior that is intentional. That is, with regard to eating, drinking, etc., one is not purposely to pursue a path that is to the detriment of another. To give offense, therefore, does not so much mean to hurt someone's feelings as to behave in such a way as to prevent someone else from hearing the gospel or to alienate someone who is already a brother or sister. No, it's much more than just about hurting someone's feelings. It's about actually placing a roadblock so that the gospel message won't be heard. The word helpful can mean bringing together, bearing a burden together, bear suffering with, be in harmony with, or it was also used to describe coming together in marriage. That word translated helpful. So it is a very loaded word that Paul used. Now, the next ring, 2 and 6. In your own private homes, don't worry about purchasing meat at the market. Basically what Paul is saying. In brief, Paul is saying, eat without thinking about the scruples you have been taught by tradition. In other words, a Christian does enjoy a freedom from mere social conventions and mere religious regulations. Freedom is found in relationship to God, and action is to be determined in the context of divine-human relationships. To put Paul's point of view into paraphrase, if you aren't worried about offending God, don't worry about other things.
Kind of like hanging out with everybody, Tarek. I like hanging out with him. He was a sweet guy. He really had a lot of this. It was really, having a relationship with him was exactly like what Paul is talking about. You in no way, shape, or form could use any of your, it was really neat because he was so faithful and such a faithful person in his religion that he actually brought out more of my own Christianity than I ever expected to from a Muslim. And that, I think, is what Paul is trying to say, is that through honoring his faith and seeing his faithfulness as willingly as it was, made my faith stronger. And I think that's what Paul's asking us to do, is that he wasn't doing it in offense. He would always say, like, you know, I Christian or Buddhist, whatever, he doesn't care. He just wanted people to know that he loved his God. And he was gonna. He said that kings and queens. Everybody is a king and queen. Everybody's a king and queen. Everybody's a king and queen. And you know, his English was so broken, it was hard to understand him sometimes. But it wasn't when he spoke in that regard. And so it was really, it was an honor to meet that young man. He is a great friend too. Real loyal person. You know, and so when you meet somebody in that regard, it's very easy to just say, okay, no problem.
And you know, it's easy to like somebody that treats you like a queen or king.
Exactly, but that's what Paul's asking us to do in the same way, is to treat those people with such, you know, I mean, Tarek was like, oh, you're my buddy, and genuine, like, oh, you're my best friend, for hanging out with him for a couple hours, inviting him on my boat, you know, and saying, oh, yeah, come hang out with me. And it really made me sad when him and his wife left this summer, because it was like, gosh, I just got to meet him and spend time with him, and just a really genuine person. And I don't care who you are or where you come from, when somebody exudes that, it's beyond protocol. Pretty cool.
So Paul's defense of why he can say that without thinking about the scruples he has been taught by tradition is because everything belongs to God. So this comes from Psalm 24, verse 1. Now, the Jewish rabbis use this psalm to defend the contention that a blessing must be said over every meal, which is a very ironic. Here's what commentary explains. But what Paul here does is full of irony by using Psalm 24, verse 1. It's full of irony toward his Jewish heritage, whether intended or not. The rabbis saw the text as the reason for thanking God for their food, but the food they thus blessed had been thoroughly investigated before the prayer. Paul now uses the text to justify eating all foods, even those forbidden by Jews, since God is the ultimate source of food, even that sold in the Methilon, or the marketplace, the common marketplace. For that reason, it can be taken with thanksgiving. The clear implication is that nothing contaminates food as such along the way. Apart from his radical statements on circumcision, it is hard to imagine anything more un-Jewish in the apostle than this. So I think the point of this ring here is the question that a Christian ought to ask about every action that he or she takes is, how does this communicate the character of God to the world?
That you... people notice when you're interested in them. And when it's... especially food, and people have gone out of their way to be hospitable to you, and then you have to draw attention to yourself. Self, 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 self. This self doesn't do this and this and this and this. Okay, so now you've just kind of dashed your relationship, because now, not really. I mean, they're going to be trying to tread on eggs so they don't offend you, but you haven't learned anything about them. You haven't taken the time to learn about them. You know, it's always easy to be friends with people who are interested in you, but are you interested in them?
So Paul has dealt now with eating in your own home. Says, doesn't matter. What you eat in your own home doesn't matter. Next ring. What about when a Christian is invited to dinner at an unbeliever's home? Paul's default position is, again, don't worry about the food and its origins. Paul writes that he himself partakes of marketplace meat. Well, doesn't find it a problem. Thankfulness builds up. Now, thankfulness, whether to God or maybe to the pagan host. Thanking the pagan host for inviting and offering builds up. And that's the whole point of this passage, is do things that are helpful, do things that build up. Do all things to the glory of God. Commentary here reads, the reader sees that Paul addresses the entire congregation, as is evident in the plural you forms that he employs throughout this discussion. Initially, in this verse, he tells the Corinthians that in a typical, uncomplicated situation, they are to eat even at the home of those who are not believers. without worrying about the source of the foods they are served. Apparently, Christian freedom meant that Christians did not have to go out of their way to comply with particular socio-religious conventions. Christians don't have to be so concerned with regulations.
Well, it would make sense because it's like, okay, here, the hardest part about all this for me is you want to talk about baggage. This seems like complete common sense. Like, don't you want friends? Aren't friends fun? Isn't it great to be around other people? Don't you want to have a good time when you're around them? And if you're always, like, fact-checking your logbook to make sure that this IRS agent of God isn't going to come down on top of you to make sure that you're having a good time the right way. Wouldn't that would suck? Wouldn't be fun at all, man. You can't have fun like that. It's like when I go to people's houses to drink beer. It's like, I'm going to go because I'm going to have fun with those people because they drink and it's funny to watch them get drunk sometimes. You know, or whatever. But I'm never going to go with the position of like, well, it's okay that you drink, but I don't because it's better for me and it probably is better for you too. You know, I never do that. I hate doing that. You know, it just causes a conflict between me and that person and then suddenly I don't have as good a friend anymore.
So lately, when I go, and they know I don't drink, but they say, so would you like some B vitamins?
But it's a tenuous thing, and a lot of times what happens is that maybe I don't necessarily put myself in a position to be friends with people that I would have to work so hard to accommodate. So it's not that I pick my friends wisely or that I won't hang out with people that do or don't do something, but I generally find time with people that don't do those things. And that gives me a better chance of not having to go against mine or their moral values to be friends with them. But I think that people, that would be a tough life. I'm sorry, but that would be a hard life to feel like I needed to check the Bible every time I went to somebody's house to make sure that I was doing it right. I mean, that would just not be fun.
Paul is addressing, there are some personalities that probably do live on that level, and Paul is not criticizing, and he said, it's okay, but you probably better not go as a missionary.
It's probably not your calling.
Well, I mean, and that's what, is this what Corinthians is about? Is about missionary? It's not about a general person of the Christian faith trying to make it through life?
Yeah, throughout Paul's main concern is that the church is not being missionary-minded.
It never has been.
It's the well.
I'm sorry, but every Christian I've ever met is the first thing to do is tell me what I'm doing.
The Corinthian church is so concerned about who's right, who's wrong among themselves that
they shouldn't move to another community and do it.
I've never had a single one of them ever say, "Have a good day, love God, take care." Always it's, have a good day. It was great to meet you. And if you want to make sure you're going to be okay, let me give you this last piece of information. It's never been just, hey, you're a good guy. Have a good day. You know? And I've always heard that. I've never heard somebody just be happy to be with somebody as a friend. And that I would understand to be the most PR that you could ever get is to just be friendly with people.
I have to make a notion, you never met Paul, did you? In person. I think Paul is, that's exactly what Paul said. That's what we are.
You know what it leads to, though, is if you are friendly with people, you can get into these totally, like, outlandish philosophical conversations with them, where, like, you both are just kind of rattling on your own individual perceptions of something, and basically nobody's actually listening to the other person. They're just going on about the thing that they like the most. And then at the end, maybe later on, somebody goes, well, yeah, that was kind of interesting what they were saying. And nobody's ever offended by it, and it's pretty cool. I mean, it works. It's kind of...
Nobody's out to win the other person. It's not a battle of winning.
No, you're not trying to convert at all.
You're just listening.
You're just enjoying the company of another human being.
But can you really have good Christian interaction if you don't really offend someone?
I knew that was coming.
So, in typical, you know, good Hebrew fashion, the climax and the main point is found in the center. Number four here.
That's why apples have the seeds in the middle.
So, you're invited to, a Christian is invited to dinner in an unbeliever's home. The host offers this spread. And someone points out that this meat served was offered to idols. Paul says Christians have a responsibility to take heed. But who precisely is this someone? So first, okay, so this is taking place at a banquet hosted by an unbeliever. It's not in your own home. It's not at the church potluck. It's an unbeliever's home. Is it the host, a pagan fellow guest, or a fellow believing guest? The language used, so this is where we come, to sacrificial meat versus idol meat. Sacrificial meat is pagan terminology. Paul doesn't use idol meat, which is the Jewish Christian terminology, which suggests that this someone is an unbeliever rather than a believer. And the use of someone rather than he suggests a fellow guest rather than a host. Because if it was the host, well, first, why would the host point serve something and point out to his guest? You know, that's kind of illogical to begin with. But in the way that this verse reads, if one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner, so this is the host, and you're disposed to go eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience, but if someone, it doesn't say, but if he says to you, but if someone.
Could this get complicated?
So grammatically, it points to a fellow unbelieving guest who is present at the same banquet.
That goes, this is offered to idols.
The pagan guest is trying to, quote, help out the Christian guest by pointing out the source of the food. So the responsible Christian, out of love, ought to heed the pagan guest's concern, even though as a Christian he has no concern as to what the food's origins.
So is he going to offend the host, though, by, like, maybe some loudmouth saying, could you run into that? Because it could be just a conscious person trying to be nice, but at the same time, it could be somebody also, like, hey, there's a Christian fool over here that doesn't eat this stuff.
You got to,
you know, and you say
you
something.
Walk the narrow line.
So you are to say, oh, okay, and then not eat it?
You just say, thank you.
The host you have to assume that the host is a very intelligent person.
Yeah, you have to assume that the host knows something about you already.
So you're going to say, thank you for reminding me.
Yes.
Darn, that looked good.
And the next day, if you go back to the same house, that party is not there, what are you going to do?
Well, you're gonna be like, hey, George, how much money to eat some of that got leftovers?
I think you don't make an issue of it.
No, I don't use the word damn.
I think you don't make an issue of it either way, because if you do, then you might as well have eaten it the day before instead.
To
blank with
you.
You
have to the host is an intelligent person.
Yeah. The clue lies in the meaning of the word conscience, which is not to be understood as a moral arbiter, the way we define it.
Yeah, that's one thing he pointed out, that they say conscience, that does not go at all the way we think of in the Western world.
You mean it's not that little Jiminy on your shoulder?
Yeah,
no,
it's not that.
That's why, if you notice in the verse text, I added the little in the brackets, scruples. So, it's not to be understood as a moral arbiter of right and wrong, but as moral consciousness. Consciousness.
Consciousness.
So you're not supposed to be doing it like, oh, God's going to get me if I do this.
That's not the point at all. It's about, you know, traditions.
Yeah.
The one who has pointed out the sacrificial origins of this meat to a Christian has done so out of a sense of moral obligation to the Christian, believing that Christians like Jews would not eat such food, so as not to offend that person nor his or her moral expectations of Christians. And precisely because it is not a matter of Christian moral consciousness, one should forbear under these circumstances.
You don't say, you dope, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
Well, if that person happened to be a junior Christian.
That's the next quote commentary here. If this is the correct understanding of the text, then what Paul is not referring to is a fellow believer's conscience as restricting the actions of another.
As is through that with the weaker brother thing, pardon me?
As is so often assumed.
Okay.
The significance of this observation is that Paul does not allow any Christian to make food a matter of Christian concern. He does not even do that in Romans 14, where he does allow people their differences in such matters.
So the person pointing it out was just a person who knew him enough to know his scruples, and they were, or his
thought he knew,
and
he was
say, not a Christian. Oh, by the way, like somebody would say to me, oh, this one has meat in it, so you might not want it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all. It was just a helpful person.
It was someone trying to be helpful.
Thank God they said something.
I just avoid everything unless I know. I
well,
try not to
You
ask.
Spent a lot of time on the weaker brother.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he told us we are not supposed to live our lives walking on eggs, not to offend the weaker brother, if the weaker brother is using it as a tool.
Right.
And I, you know what's really strange is okay, so as a host, normally when you go to like Thanksgiving dinners or when you go to a banquet, you're not always served your plate. A lot of the time you serve your own plate. So in a way you're always capable of taking only what you will consume.
Yeah, that's kind of a Western thing.
So the serving, you sat down to a served plate.
You would be served, or a plate would get passed around, and you would be expected to take it.
I can tell stories about that.
Well, see, that's what I would wonder, because my grandmother always made a huge deal out of, no matter where you go, you eat what's on your plate. Because if you sit down to somebody's table and they've got freaking eyeballs on the plate, you better dang well take a bite of it. Because that's what you...
I see.
You know, exactly.
You're going to see more and more.
She was great.
She was very Greek. She'd eat anything.
Well, finally, we come to the very last verse. The first verse of chapter 11. So what Paul is saying there is, you know, in those places where Paul's actions reflect that of Christ's, the Corinthians are also to imitate. You know, Paul is a living, breathing example of what Christ would have done. So, in summary here, of this particular portion, just as knowledge must be tempered with love, that was the problem at the opening. You know, the Corinthians were saying, oh, we know idols don't exist, so it doesn't matter what we eat or where we eat it. We can go to pagan worship services and eat there because idols aren't real. And Paul says, okay, so the idols, I'll agree, idols aren't real, but that whole
representation
of what you're doing may reflect negatively upon, you know, a weaker brother.
Ideas are real. Like if a person has an idea of something,
it's like, I know
it's
this
very real.
So what Paul introduced in that opening piece was, there's the objective reality that idols aren't real, but there's a subjective reality that by participating in these things, you are being influenced by the ideas that are being presented. And for many new Christians who were just coming out of that sort of environment, the subjective reality is that even though they know objectively that idols don't exist, subjectively they're emotionally still attached. So they still fear the gods. So, a Christian needs to defer to subjective reality out of love. Paul, in this segment, continues to prepare and foreshadow for his readers chapter 13, on the chapter on love. Love is the guiding principle. So the larger question is not, what does freedom assure me, but rather, what does love require of me? If there's one law that Christians have, it's love. How can I best love my neighbor? How can I best love the other?
By feeding a crab. Oh my goodness.
Essay number 3. So in summary for this entire essay, consumption of sacrificial meat should not concern Christians, wherever it occurs, except eating as a part of idol worship is prohibited. And when an unbeliever points out the sacrificial meat to you, out of concern for his conscience, you should refrain. Second point is, don't make eating and drinking a test of Christian fellowship. It's what some of the Corinthians were trying to do. So not in the usual, not in the modern sense where, you know, where maybe it's like, you know, Christian sense think, well, you know, if you don't eat certain things, then you're really Christian. On the Corinthians were saying, if you don't come eat with us at the temple, you aren't really a Christian. You know, because we're free to do whatever we want now. You know, idols aren't real. So we should go to the temple and participate in their feasts. And if you don't, well, are you really a Christian? That was what they were asking.
Yeah.
It was probably just like Vegas. They say they have great food there. You know, I mean, not saying that that's idol worship, but it's an unusual place to go get great food. Great cheap food.
Yeah, it's not that cheap anymore.
Oh.
Yeah, a full buffet course at one of the top, you know, those buffets can run $30, $40 a person easily.
So now it's more up to normal restaurant fare.
Well, if the food's free, who cares what the stage performance behind it is?
The main point of this essay, I think, is in all things, keep mission to the other as your foremost concern. As far as it is in your power, do nothing to offend them and do everything allowable to integrate with them so that your actions and your words will be seen as God's glory and gospel.
And before you go as a missionary, you better have some introspect to see if you're fit.
Well, you qualified 10A2, but you didn't put 10A3.
What's 10A3?
When a believer points out the sacrificial meat to you,
if a believer, yeah.
You kind of told us that we should quit catering to the believer weak person who is using it as a power struggle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of part of B. Don't make eating and drinking a test of Christian fellowship.
So we kind of need to tell the weak guy who's using it as a power struggle to grow up.
Without offending.
Mind your own business.
Without offending unnecessarily.
Unnecessarily. There you go. Some people see, that's what you talk about. Some people love to be offended in order to control.
Yeah.
That's
all Christians that is a form what if possible not to offend, but that's all up to interpretation, you know. So it has to just be you to decide how to govern yourself, because another person tramples everybody and you're
what Paul's life demonstrates is that Paul really wasn't concerned about what other Christians thought of him. He would do as he pleased. What he thought was best for every situation in order to be a missionary to the other. And if that meant offending, quotes, offending other Christians, he didn't give it a concern.
So the Christian who is using being offended as a power struggle is kind of left out to...
Yeah.
They're in their own little world, you know. I'm, you know, you just have to keep moment by moment in that thought process, because, you know, I'm probably...
The object is to love people. That's the bottom line. And in your squirmishness not to use spiders, I highly doubt you have offended anybody.
So, everybody draws the line somewhere.
People are intelligent. They understand.
Why you don't want
the object is not to go out there and eat everything that, you know, the object isn't to go eat spiders. The object is not to offend. And I don't think you've offended.
So this final paragraph comes from the commentary again. Despite this passage, the issue of personal freedom in matters that are adiaphora, or non-essentials, and the limitations of freedom for the sake of others continue to haunt the church. Usually the battle rages over what constitutes adiaphora. Conservatives on these issues simply fail to reckon how liberal Paul's own view really is.
They don't want it.
Hence, Paul is seldom hurt for the sake of traditional regulations. On the other hand, the assertion of freedom to the hurt of others is not the biblical view either. However, in most contemporary settings, the quotes offended are not unbelievers or new Christians, but those who tend to confuse their own regulations with the eternal will of God.